Captivated by Brainerd, the congregation asked him to stay on as its minister. Though the town was very attractive and he would have been in the midst of many old friends, Brainerd resolved to go on still with the Indian affair. The congregation then called the same Mr. Buell, who had lived with the Edwardses, and he stayed there for 52 years. Brainerd was less lonely after this because his Scottish sponsors budgeted enough money for him to take along two other Indians in addition to his clever interpreter. He thought this was a good time for one more try at the Delaware Valley, a desolate and hideous country above New Jersey, where were very few settlements. This proved a formidable target. It was the most difficult and dangerous traveling any of us had ever seen. We had scarce anything else but lofty mountains, deep valleys, and hideous rocks to make our way through. In this unpromising place, Brainerd's horse broke its leg and had to be shot. Slogging on by foot, Brainerd reflected, "I can't get her place supplied for 50 pounds, though even then a young man named Nehemiah Greenman of Southbury, Connecticut, was attending college on a scholarship donated by Brainerd. This mishap made him feel pinched for money for the first time in his life, and he sold a tea kettle and an iron pot. An early frost added to their discomfort, and the party spent several bone-chilling nights before they came upon the shelter of an Indian camp on the riverside. It was the hunting season. When braves had to go out for the deer, they would urgently need to store for winter. But Brainerd was so magnetic that the braves stayed home to hear a sermon, missing a day of hunting. The missionaries pushed on up the river. Though a northeast storm kept them from making fires, their horses ate some poisonous food, and Brainerd himself picked up a digestive ailment. Though the region was forbidding, the Delaware Indians turned out to be even-tempered, with a stable communal life in long houses. But Brainerd observed that they seemed not to know what they thought of themselves. As converts, they were problematical. One named Moses Tatamy exploited his conversion enough that one of his sons achieved a Princeton education. He may have been a forerunner of the Rice Christians, who mixed faith with expediency. On May 30, after riding 340 miles under harsh conditions, Brainerd rode to Princeton in a very weak state, had such a violent fever, by the way, that I was forced to alight at a friend's house and lie down for some time. Near night was visited by Mr. Treat, Mr. Beatty, and his wife, and another friend. My spirits were refreshed to see them, but I was surprised and even ashamed that they had taken such pains as to ride 30 or 40 miles to see me. Beatty was probably the vigorous minister from Neshaminy, Pennsylvania, who started life as a peddler and later was on a committee that was instrumental in founding the first American life insurance company, which still is thriving. This entry suggests a puzzle about Brainerd. Though his diaries sound glum, his public personality was open and attractive. Edwards had a theory that Brainerd's melancholy came from remorse about the way he had acted at Yale. He abhorred himself for his imprudent zeal and misconduct at that time. While Brainerd was being charming to many people, a segment of him stood aside. He wrote about one bright Sunday when he had preached on a sunlit hillside to a large responsive group of people. Another man would have been gratified by so much attention, but David Brainerd later confided to his diary that night, was too much crowded with company and conversation, and longed to be more alone with God. Edwards, a psychologist, before the word was coined, observed of Brainerd that there were some imperfections which ran through his whole life. Yet he went on to emphasize this complex young man was being refined and tested by the process of living. His grace ripened. The religious exercises of his heart became more and more pure, and he more and more distinguishing in his judgment. The longer he lived, he had much to teach and purify him. In the summer of 1745, when Brainerd preached at the Forks of the Delaware, he had results that would have gratified a man of different ego needs. Yet his own version of the day was, "I never saw the work of God appear so independent of means as at this time. I could scarce believe he used me as an instrument." The dark night of his soul was shading into a kind of dawn, and he worked harder than ever. To his brother John, he wrote in December, "I am in one continued, perpetual, and uninterrupted hurry." He also pushed himself strenuously to take his share of responsibility for church government, making tremendous rides just to participate in an ordination or to vote in a meeting. His brother, Nehemiah, had died of tuberculosis in 1742, and now Brainerd's own body began to pay for the many weeks of exposure and lack of sleep in damp forests. Too late, he realized, as Edwards put it, that he ought to have taken more thorough care. Brainerd spent a miserable winter as the classic symptoms of tuberculosis slashed away at his body. Though his voice grew hoarse and swallowing was difficult, he would force himself to preach to his Indians, even as he shook with fever. Fortunately, by now he had come to Cranberry, New Jersey, where kindly Indians welcomed him and helped him build his fourth residence in an Indian colony. A characteristic of tuberculosis is the alternation of periods of physical prostration with times of remission when the creative energies frantically accelerate. By spring, Brainerd dared to think he was better. He wrote on April 21, "I set out on my journey to New England in order, if it might be the will of God, to recover my health by riding." On May 28, 1746, Brainerd turned up in Northampton, and the family welcomed him with no idea that they were receiving disaster into their house. It was not proved until 1868 that tuberculosis was contagious. Before that time, everyone thought it was a hereditary disease because it pounced upon whole families. Brainerd had perked up enough to believe that he was going to be well. Edwards wrote that he was vastly better than, by his own account, he had been in the winter. The sunniest side of Brainerd's nature was forward when he came to the Edwards house, and he promptly captivated the whole family. Edwards wrote that they found him remarkably sociable, pleasant, and entertaining in his conversation. He enjoyed not only the benefit of his conversation, but had the comfort and the advantage of hearing him pray in the family from time to time. Particularly impressed was Jerusha, the daughter Edwards had described it to Erskine as a very pleasant and useful member of this household, the flower of the family. Brainerd was then 28 years old, and Jerusha was only 17, but the whole family could see that, as Edwards put it, she was a person of much the same spirit as Brainerd. The young man singled out Jerusha, telling her that his favorite sister had the same name. Jerusha Brainerd Spencer had named her son David Brainerd after her brother. As Jerusha helped her mother carry in the vegetable tureens and brought more hot water for the teapot, she intently watched the guest. When the family bowed their heads at the table, Edwards invited Brainerd to say the blessing. Edwards later wrote, "I know not that ever I heard him so much as ask a blessing or return thanks at table, but there was something remarkable to be observed." Though Sarah Edwards shared the general appreciation for their winning guest, she noticed how thin he was and how bright his eyes were. The next day, she suggested to Dr. Mather that he stop in to see Brainerd. The stethoscope had not yet been invented, but the case history of tuberculosis could be read by a seasoned observer. Dr. Mather, an experienced doctor by this time, examined Brainerd, then came straight to the point and said he could give him no encouragement. After he had absorbed that verdict, Brainerd decided to make a last trip to Boston to wind up his affairs and arrange for his mission to pass along to others. Then Jerusha did a thing that must have been unusual for those times, and her mother surprisingly responded. Jerusha asked to go along with Brainerd, and her mother let her do it. The couple started on June 9, traveling slowly. Along the road, they met a group of clergy and joined them for the rest of the way to Boston. The beauty of the weather and the company of Jerusha made Brainerd realize that he desired the continuance of life. Through roses and flowering shrubs and all the blandishments of early summer, they moved east and came to Boston on June 12. Brainerd told his journal, "God appeared excellent, his ways full of pleasure and peace." Elated by the joy of these days, Brainerd felt his health had surged back, and he bustled about Boston, introducing Jerusha to his friends and meeting hers. But by June 18, he was jolted again. Doctors concluded that the ulcers in his lungs had broken. Jerusha wrote to the family, "On Thursday, he was ill with a violent fever. We were up with him until 1 or 2 o'clock, expecting every hour would be his last." Brainerd's brother, Israel, was notified of his illness, and he hastened up to Boston from Connecticut. He brought news that rocked Brainerd, for he reported that Jerusha Spencer had suddenly died down in Haddam. This was a fearful blow to the brother, who had a peculiarly dear affection for her. Boston extended itself to cheer up the grieving Brainerd. Gifts poured in. He was given 3 dozen Bibles to take back to his Indians, as well as cash and pledges that made secure the future of his mission. Then the cruel caprice of his disease gave Brainerd another false reprieve. On July 19, he felt well enough to put in a day of church going that would seem strenuous even to a healthy man. He rode in a chaise in the morning to hear Joseph Sewell preach. Then he took communion, and the afternoon saw him going out again to hear Thomas Prince conduct the second service. When it was time for David and Jerusha to start the trip back to Northampton, a troop of admirers went along to the edge of town to say goodbye. Taking advantage of the cool of the afternoon's low slanting sun, they started late in the day. To Jerusha's relief, Israel went along to help her. She needed his assistance, for Brainerd was extremely tired and faint on the road. After traveling only a cautious 16 miles most days, they finally made it back to Northampton. There Brainerd had a continual desire to improve time. He wrote many letters, corrected his journal, contributed the preface for a book about to be published in Boston. Jerusha riding beside him, he even continued to take exercise, going out on horseback. On September 2, the strong vein of sociability in his nature made Brainerd go out to the public lecture, for he wanted to see all the old friends who had turned up in town for that event. But, as Edwards reported, it was the last time he ever went out at our gate. 2 days later, Brainerd had to give up climbing stairs, and Sarah had to fix up a bedroom downstairs for him. She was pregnant again, and the next weeks were grim for her. Illness in any house is taxing for the mother, and it was harder in those days when bandages had to be tediously made than laundered for reuse. Washing and all forms of nursing were more awkward than they are now. Sarah was additionally anguished to see Jerusha under such a strain, for Jerusha lashed herself to do all the nursing, though others offered to help. The household chores increased because Brainerd's brothers, Israel and John, came to see him, and two other young men chose that awkward time to arrive to talk with Edwards about their interest in preparing for the ministry. That Sarah survived those weeks speaks of how much she must have drawn upon her deep devotional resources. The day of the visit of the young ministerial aspirants, September 29, was actually a pleasant one. Brainerd quizzed the young men about their sense of calling to the vocation, and all the family gathered with them around the bed while they sang together Psalm 102. One would like to know how Sarah handled her smaller children on the day the pale invalid on the first floor called the children in one by one and whispered to each in turn, "When you see my grave, then remember what I said to you while I was alive. Then think with yourself how that man who lies in that grave warned me to prepare for death." Did the children have nightmares after they went to bed that night, or had the sermons they had heard every Sunday of their memory, spoken in the dear, familiar voice of their father, prepared them to be matter-of-fact about the fragility of life, the nearness of the grave? Fortunately, the family was spared the trial of having to cope with a delirious patient. Until the day before his death, he had the free use of his reason, excepting that at times he appeared a little lost for a moment. For Jerusha, the most strenuous scene came on the morning of October 4. While she was puttering with his pillow, or perhaps coaxing him to have a cup of tea, Brainerd said, "Dear Jerusha, are you willing to part with me? I am quite willing to part with you, though if I had thought I should not see you and be happy with you in another world, I could not bear to part with you." On October 8, a friend came to call, and Brainerd talked with him, then continued late at night in earnest talk with his brother John. Brainerd asked John to suggest to the Indians in his congregation that they join with the Scottish preachers in Edwards' plan for a united day of prayer. Later, the Indians did so with great cheerfulness and unanimity. The next day, Brainerd died, saying, "It is another thing to die than people imagine." Edwards, with inadvertent snobbery, reported that in the tranquil cemetery which slopes toward a wide view of hills, 8 neighboring ministers and 17 other gentlemen of liberal education and a great concourse of people attended the services. Using as his text, "True saints, when absent from the body, are present with the Lord," Edwards eulogized the young man who had made a tragic impression on his own family. Jerusha, who had nursed Brainerd for 19 weeks, then caved in herself, and the whole grim matter had to be endured again. Her resistance was greater, and she was acutely ill only 5 days. But on February 14, Valentine's Day, Jerusha died. It happened at 5 a.m. on a Sunday, and on that day, for the first time in his life, Edwards preached an old sermon out of his barrel to his own congregation. He used one he had given 7 years before on the book of Job. So for the first time, there was a small stone bearing the Edwards name in that peaceful knoll in the cemetery at Northampton. David Brainerd had intended his papers to be destroyed, but his friends in Boston persuaded him to turn all his materials over to Edwards. At that point, Edwards could not have forced himself to do any other writing, but he comforted himself by rummaging through Brainerd's papers and shaping them into a memoir. Published in 1747, this modest project surprisingly became Edwards's most widely read book, and it had long reverberations. In England, it was discovered by William Carey, a brilliant, self-educated shoemaker. Inspired by that story, Carey had the idea of founding the London Missionary Society. Then, in 1806, a group of Williams College students were walking in a field near their campus when a rain came up. They dived into a haystack for shelter, and there, while they waited for the squall to stop, they talked. One of the group, Samuel Mills, had just been reading about Brainerd and Carey, and he told the rest about them. Moved by the stories, they decided to become America's first foreign missionaries. All of them went on to Andover Seminary, and in June 1810 took their plan to the General Association of Congregational Ministers. To deal with this unprecedented suggestion, the ministers set up the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. A major figure on that first board was a son of Mary Edwards, Jerusha's sister. So the Brainerd influence came full circle back to the house in Northampton again. In spite of all the upheaval Brainerd had caused in the Edwards' house, all the emotional toll, and the crowning anguish of losing Jerusha, Edwards could say, "I would not conclude my observations without acknowledging with thankfulness the gracious dispensation of Providence to me and my family in so ordering it that he should be brought to my house in his last sickness." How much this ordeal cost Sarah is told in the fact that the baby she had been carrying proved to be her only puny one. On May 6, 2 months after Jerusha died, Elizabeth was born. She had rickets and was always frail, but the family doted on her. She appeared when they all needed a new channel for their deepest feelings. Sarah experienced then for the first time the grief that often struck down other mothers. The ache for a lost child is a form of bereavement like no other. This loss was peculiarly poignant because it happened on Valentine's Day, one of the merriest days in the colonial calendar, when there was much ado about parties and secret slipping of elaborate handmade cards under doorsteps. In 1746, all of the social New York reverberated when Mrs. James Alexander, a grand dame, refused to let her daughter accept a valentine from the new young organist of Trinity Church. Holidays are hard to bear after a loss, for they emphasize the changes the year has made since the same date 12 months before, and it is lonely to be sad on a festive occasion. For Sarah, Valentine's Day now became an annual reminder of a scar she would carry forever. Chapter 11. Present Tense. At last we arrive at an entire annihilation of ourselves, and an absolute acquiescence and complacence in the will of God, which afford the only full answer to all our doubts and the only radical cure for all our evils and perplexities. David Hartley, 705 through 1757. What component gives a town, a church, a corporation, a college its distinction? So that one is yeasty and hopeful, another drab and cantankerous? What causes the youngsters of one city all to wish to return there to live, while another town has no partisans? There may have been an atmospheric factor that made Northampton from its earliest days a community given to quarrels. Perhaps some combination of genes among the founding families led to clashes. Once relationships curdle, all exchanges that flow from them are affected. The bitter word once shouted, the dish smashed in anger, the cheek reddened with a slap, the love withdrawn, a climactic scene played, the emotional mark of such scenes lingers. Superficially, it can be explained that Northampton had been divided between a court party, which had wealth, land, and authority, and the country people, who resented the power the first group had over town and church. The two sides habitually collided on issues and kept a suspicious eye on each other between controversies. Other towns with similar social alignments did not have such frictions as Northampton appears to have had. In 1677, when the church got a new bell, the village empowered Enos Kingsley to sue for the wheat sent down by Mr. Stevens to pay for the new church bell, which he pretends was spoiled and so gives no account for it. In 1656, Joseph Parsons sued James Bridgman for slander because he had called Mrs. Parsons a witch. She turned out to be actually a sleepwalker. In 1658, a year notable because that was when the town built a boat to use on river crossings, there was a breach or rant in town concerning the Lord's Day's meetings. Later, there was a prolonged quarrel over the office of measurer of land. Two men were asked to take it, but each refused to serve. There was prolonged bickering in the area about the border between Massachusetts and Connecticut. Edwards was to point out, "The contentions which have been among you since I first became your pastor have been one of the greatest burdens I have labored under, not only the contentions you have had with me, but those you have had with one another about your land and other concerns." Edwards's problem was compounded by a rising wave of resentment at the clergy that was a general condition throughout the colonies. As early as 1643, Henry Walton of Lynn, Massachusetts, was taken to court for saying that he had as leave to hear a dog bark as to hear Mr. Cobbett preach. Such cockiness on the part of many individuals foreshadowed the revolutionary spirit. Rich and successful now, the colonies did not need to be told what to do by Hookers and Mathers. One church record of June 1725 reported, "Some evil-minded persons placed a sturgeon of about 8 feet in length on the pulpit floor, where it laid undiscovered until the Lord's Day following, which occasioned them to perform their exercise in the orchard." In Sarah's home church of New Haven in 1738, Timothy Hutchinson was required to make humble confession of sin for smiling in church. and the Episcopal scare, stirred up by Timothy Cutler's departure from Yale, made the founders of First Church in Waterbury, Connecticut, so jittery that before they would hire Mark Leavenworth as their minister, they made him post a bond of £500 on the promise that he wouldn't turn Episcopalian. Their ground for suspicion was that Leavenworth's wife had a cousin who was Episcopalian. An Albany preacher who offended his people found on his doorstep one Monday morning a club, a pair of old shoes, a crust of black bread, and a dollar. The minister read this as a hint to leave town. So he did. Lemuel Bryant was dismissed from John Adams' church in Braintree, Massachusetts, on the charge that he was light and gay. And a minister in Pomfret, Connecticut, was suspended by the Ministers Association because he had preached a sermon, which we have very good grounds to believe was not of his own composition. This charge might remove some clergy from their pulpits today. In the earlier years, when small groups of settlers had to stand together in order to survive the rigors of the wilderness, they had to define strictly the terms for their collective life. They were in an unusual way bound up in one another's welfare, so they had to draw up firm rules. Bachelors were fined for keeping house alone. A person was fined 3 shillings if he stood outside the meeting house chatting while services were going on. Parents were required to teach their children the town laws. It all made for group solidarity when solidarity could mean the difference between survival or death. But times had eased. The earlier austerities of the church were beginning to be resented. The first settlers found virtue in being as bored and uncomfortable as the human frame could endure during worship. Meeting houses were so cold that communion bread would freeze, and a pastor had to keep baptismal water in a flask beneath his coat so it would be warm enough to use on a baby's head. People sat through paralyzing sermons, several hours long, and after the sermon came town announcements, baptism, the offering, and a song lined out from a bay psalm book. After the benediction, no one was allowed to wiggle until the clergyman stiffly strode down the aisle. However, congregations were sensibly asking whether it was necessary to be flagellated in church in this way. In Hadley, near Northampton, they had even dared put a stove in the meeting house. A Quaker was tarred and feathered for pointing out that church people worshipped the Sabbath, not God. But the issue he raised did not go away. Another squabble in churches concerned music. The first settlers, intent on kicking off all traces of the liturgy of the church they had left behind, had abolished all music except psalms. In 1723, a book was printed which gave both notes and words for psalms. People complained, "If we begin to sing by rule, the next thing will be to pray by rule." In England, Handel was turning out his mighty works for organ, and enough people wanted to see organs introduced in America that a Harvard senior thesis in 1730 asked, "Do organs excite a devotional spirit?" Edwards himself liked music and encouraged his people to sing, but even that matter was an abrasive one. The people in Northampton also chafed at Edwards's many errands out of town. For that day of difficult transportation, he did travel a remarkable amount. He had even gone down to East Hampton on Long Island to preach an installation sermon for young Buell, when that was the last jumping-off place. It was an attractive village, prospering in whale trade, but a visitor who came there by horseback had to wait as long as 2 days for the ferry at Lyme, Connecticut, to take him to Orient Point, and once on the island, he had a considerable ride farther. But the people who grumbled about Edwards's many absences did not realize that it was essential for him to get away, to be spiritually replenished for such a taxing parish. One amusing form of the rising anti-clericalism centered on the subject of wigs. These were heavy, hot, and expensive creations, probably invented by a bald man, and they cost at least £10 a year to maintain in good condition, though they had become a sign of rank. The church in West Newbury, Massachusetts, in 1752, met solemnly to deal with our brother Richard Bartlett. Our said brother refuses communion with the church for no other reason but because the pastor wears a wig. Edwards owned two wigs, which in his methodical way he catalogued as one best, ditto inferior. This was one more matter in which he did not endear himself to the man who worked hard with his hands and wore coarse hand-woven shirts over deerskin breeches. Sarah was not easy to understand during all this. She knew that eyes were peering at the parsonage to note every sign of extravagance, yet she did a curious thing almost defiantly, as if she enjoyed the gasps it caused. Edwards spent £11 for a gold chain and a locket for a gift for her. He may have earned some money for writing up the experience she had recited to him in 1742 and felt she deserved a dividend from that. Or the two of them may have reached a secret level of joy together, which he wanted to mark with a brilliant symbol. It would have been like him to make such a tender gesture, so absorbed in the primary relationship that he never gave thought to the reaction of the townspeople. But Sarah, alert to social nuances, wore the showy gift. Why? In 1747, the nerves of Northampton were rasped because of King George's War. The American phase of the conflict, which had begun in 1731 because of a bizarre incident in which an English master mariner's ear was cut off when his ship was boarded by some Spanish. It was known as the Jenkins Ear Incident and ultimately developed into the War of the Austrian Succession, involving not only England, France, Spain, and other European nations, but making reverberations in the American colonies. The Indians, who were allies of the French, pestered the English colonial settlements. It happened that one hot August day in nearby Southampton, Massachusetts, Elisha Clark was threshing grain in his barn when Indians killed and scalped him. In May 1748, they swooped down there again and tomahawked Noah Pixley as he was leading his cows out to pasture. Even young Jonathan Judd in the nearby parish fled to the safety of Suffield, Connecticut. In June, Colonel Stoddard had a stroke while he was in Boston attending the general court, and he asked that Sarah come to take care of him. This is interesting. There were many women in Boston who would have leaped at the chance to help so rich a man. Stoddard had 35 shirts, a gold watch worth £150, and an enormous estate. Did Stoddard want Sarah with him then because in her person she conveyed assurance of the reality of God? Stoddard, a faithful worshipper all his life, may have needed at that point to be sure his God really existed. Or did he simply want a nurse of Sarah's gentle grace? She may have seemed to him, too, an extraordinary woman. It always takes organizing when a mother leaves a large family. Menus must be planned, laundry done, lists of instructions left. The baby, Betty, was a problem because her mother had been her world to that frail child. However, Mrs. Samuel Phelps, who had stepped in to help when Sarah had briefly disintegrated in 1742, offered to take the baby. Elisha Pomeroy volunteered to ride along as Sarah's escort, so for a change, it was Sarah who cantered off and Edwards who supervised back home. They all soon realized that the house was without its heartbeat. On June 22, Edwards wrote her, addressing her as "my dear companion," and telling first how the baby was doing at Mrs. Phelps's house. The first 2 or 3 days before, she was well acquainted. She was very unquiet, but now more quiet than she used to be at home. He added a request that Sarah bring a cheese along with her from Boston and concluded, "We have been without you almost as long as we know how to be." So when Stoddard died, she hastened home to the man who needed her most. The funeral was the largest scene in the town for years. Edwards preached on a strong rod broken and withered, Ezekiel 19:12, and he characteristically chose that time to say an unpopular thing. In front of the biggest gathering of businessmen and land speculators ever collected in his meeting house, he lashed out at leaders who are of a narrow private spirit that may be found in little tricks and intrigues to promote their private interest, who will shamefully defile their hands to gain a few pounds, are not ashamed to nip and bite others, grind the faces of the poor. He spoke of how Stoddard had represented the best qualities of leadership and contrasted him with the men who misused authority. Even though she trembled to hear him, Sarah knew he had to say this sometime, and that now, with his protector dead, he had taken the risk. The moods of New Englanders are delicately hinged to weather. Nowhere else is winter so trying, the mud season so endless, spring so giddy, summer so brief, fall so glorious. Tuned to the caprices of weather, the New Englander's mood swings as the climate does. The year 1749 was one of the spooky extremes. The winter was unusually severe. Mill River had frozen over by early October. The town was smothered by 6 feet of snow that lingered monotonously for months. Then in the spring, the bridge washed out. Some jokesters made a stunt of the flood. They rowed across the river to Hadley, passed a rope from their boat through a tavern window, and anchored it on the table in a barroom, to general hilarity. The gray weeks dragged out, chill rains slanting over stubble fields, maples gauntly swaying in the harsh winds. On April 1, a date low in town morale, Edwards undiplomatically hurled at his people a sermon based on Jeremiah 23:29. "Is not my word like fire, says the Lord, and like a hammer which breaks the rock in pieces?"
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3000, 3730 by fax at 780-468-1096 or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.